Okay. It is June 26th.
It is my Friday.
That voice that you hear, ladies and gentlemen, is none other than our music expert extraordinaire, Ara Wagner. How are you? Welcome to the Android Central podcast.
Thank you for having me here. It's been a while since I've been back.
I know. I think it was pre-me hosting this joint, right?
I think so.
Yeah, so it's been a couple years. And Jerry Hillenbrand, who was here last week. How are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm very well. It is Tuesday, June 26th. And the reason we're recording on a Tuesday is because, as we promised last week, we were going to give you an extra helping of ACP this week, the Android Central podcast supplemental. And we're doing this for a couple of reasons. We didn't hit every topic we wanted to hit on Friday, but also we wanted to talk about streaming, about YouTube music, and about the streaming music industry in general. And then we wanted to talk about streaming video and the AT&T Time Warner merger. So who better to have on than two experts in those fields? And we're going to start with YouTube music and streaming music in general, because this is a topic, Ara, that you have written about exhaustively over the last few months. And if you haven't been following, YouTube music is not a new product, but it is a sort of relaunched new product from Google. And it's quickly becoming obvious that YouTube Music is going to be the company's flagship streaming service, bolstered by YouTube Premium. So why don't you take us back to 2015, when Google actually announced YouTube Music, and walk us through to today, where YouTube Music has evolved into this behemoth that lives alongside the other streaming music service that Google hosts, Google Play Music.
Back in 2015, when YouTube Music launched, I, like many people, I go to YouTube because that's just like the only place to find a whole lot of music, especially music that just isn't commercially available. Things like mashups, remixes. YouTube is the only place on the internet for that. YouTube Music, it launched in 2015 and everybody got excited for the announcement. And then the app showed up and we were all just like, well, this isn't really that helpful because YouTube Music doesn't have all of the videos that are on YouTube. So that means a lot of music related videos don't show up there. Like if you listen to remixes, some of them will show up in YouTube Music and some of them won't. And that's still true today, although far, far more of them are available thanks to the record deals that have come up in that time since. But it also, it didn't have any real offline functions. The only offline function for YouTube Music until, I want to say last year, was offline mixtape. So it would download some music you liked and some music that it thought you liked but wasn't sure you liked. And that was the only thing you could listen to offline, which made YouTube Music kind of a non-starter for anybody who's picky about their music, like me.
So why then did Google even launch this product back in 2015, long before the relaunch this year? And even in 2015, Google Play Music was sort of in this weird place where Google wasn't really treating it like a first-rate product. It wasn't getting regular updates. Why launch YouTube Music 3 years ago?
Well, even 3 years ago, YouTube was one of the most trafficked websites in the world. It's the largest video platform in the world, and that makes it almost, it certainly is. It's the largest music platform in the world. Millions of people go to YouTube every day for music, and whether or not they use the actual YouTube Music app for it, YouTube is one of the most used video websites in the world. And YouTube wanted to have an app available so that people who are using it for that could use it for that better. Because when you're using YouTube for regular music in the regular YouTube app, things just aren't as well designed.
You're onto something here, right? Because YouTube is this massive music platform. And a lot of the music that I see when I go to YouTube and I start listening to music, at least before YouTube Music launched or YouTube Premium, I see it in two places, right? I see the official artists page, often a Vivo page, right?
Yeah, Vivo is one of the major record label methods for getting music onto YouTube, because they'll put up they'll put up official audio quality, which when they converted to the new app turned into the standard song album listings, and then they'll put up music videos and behind the scenes.
Right. So Vivo has this sort of official presence. Vivo is a separate company. It's a music distributor. It's a music video platform, but they never really got the leverage on their own site and their own apps that they had on YouTube. So even though the Vivo is still there, most of the traffic from the official Vivo stuff comes through YouTube. And there, on the other hand, there's all this user uploaded music, the lyric, you know, the lyric videos, the sort of the stuff that sounds okay, but it's certainly not approved by the record labels. So how does YouTube deal with this? I mean, is this the kind of stuff you're talking about, where people would be able to access music on YouTube that they wouldn't be able to get officially through, say, Spotify or Google Play?
Yeah, there's a lot of music. Like, there are albums out there that are out of print and don't have digital rights. That's certainly true for a lot of, like, older soundtracks and old concert recordings. A lot of that stuff will get lost by the record labels, assuming that record labels ever want it put out in the first place. Fans have to upload that in order for it to be available anywhere. So YouTube is the only place you're going to find it outside of, like, basically library swaps. Because I know that for some people who collect certain types of music, they'll just swap MP3s, but that doesn't really make it available to most people. So YouTube is the number one place to go if you're looking for something and you can't find it on any of the regular stores. Because YouTube is safe, as opposed to going to God knows what site with God knows what programs running on it. And YouTube is right. Available on just about every device you can get the internet on.
That's true, except Amazon Fire TV boxes, but we won't go there right now. So fast forward, alongside YouTube Music, Google launches YouTube Red in specific markets. Tell us a little bit about YouTube Red and what happened with that over the last few years.
YouTube Red launched alongside YouTube Music because in order to listen to YouTube with the screen off, that's one of the most sought after features on YouTube. And YouTube realizes it wanted people to pay for that instead of just downloading X app and stripping the ads away. So YouTube Red gave us three features that are still, they're the heart of YouTube Premium today, but they were worth paying for on their own, but they also came with YouTube Music and Google Play Music. And those three features were background playback, the ability to play videos with the screen off or while you're doing something else on the phone, offline playback, which allows you to download YouTube videos and watch them when you're stuck in a bunker somewhere or in a plane without Wi-Fi, and getting rid of ads.
Wow. Yeah, those. So I'm in Canada, as our listeners may know, and we did not have access to YouTube Red. And Ara had this article that you would write or update every year or so, reminding people that YouTube Red is the best deal in streaming because it comes with all of these value ads for just $10 a month or whatever it was. And alongside these two products, which weren't available in many other countries, right? It was the US and I believe the UK and a couple other markets.
UK didn't actually have YouTube Red, which is why they did test some YouTube Red features in the UK, but they didn't give them the proper YouTube Red access, which is why YouTubers in the UK had the free YouTube Red type features like background playback stripped from their accounts. And now they have to pay to add them back with YouTube Premium now.
Okay, so what were the launch markets for YouTube Premium or YouTube Music and YouTube Red?
United States, Australia, South Korea, Mexico, and there was a fifth one. Oh, New Zealand.
New Zealand, yeah. The small country that nobody remembers in south of Australia. Hey, New Zealanders, if you're listening. So take us then to today. So a couple of months ago, Google announces that there's this new product, which is in fact a repackaging of an old product, YouTube Music. It's coming to those five markets, and it would launch in 12 other markets later in the year. And alongside that, they announced Google or YouTube Premium. So why was this announcement such a big deal, given that at the time, it didn't seem like a major reshuffling of Google's streaming strategy? It was just an upgrade and a name change over the existing YouTube Music and YouTube Red.
For YouTube Music, it got a very big... They completely redesigned the app. They gave us the desktop site for it, finally. So they were finally giving YouTube Music the concentrated push and the marketing that it deserved back in 2015 that they didn't give it then and just sort of let the service kind of flounder, which is why they said YouTube Music is all new, because nobody remembers the original YouTube Music except for a couple of music nerds like me. And yeah, the reason that they upgraded YouTube Red from YouTube Red to YouTube Premium is that since they were going to be launching in all of these new markets, they wanted to be able to start at a higher price for YouTube Premium than what the users in the YouTube Red markets have been paying, which is why YouTube Red turned into YouTube Premium and grandfathered in everybody that was on YouTube Red before. And all the other countries, if you had Google Play Music, you got grandfathered into YouTube Music, but you didn't get grandfathered into YouTube Premium.
Got it. Okay. So they also increased the price by a couple of bucks for YouTube Music and YouTube Premium for those who had come in early on. Now it's 10 bucks for YouTube Music Premium and 12 bucks for YouTube Premium. Now, there is a free version of YouTube Music, but you say that it's not really a great product. Why is that?
YouTube Music for free users is going to... You have to keep the screen on YouTube Music if you're using it as a free user. The second you go away from the playback screen, the music stops, which means that this app is going to eat your... It's going to hog your screen, and it's going to hog your battery, because the screen is the thing, is the item that takes up the most battery throughout our day usually. You also can't use it for offline, and for most music apps, not being able to use it offline isn't the biggest deal in the world, but when you're streaming music, when you're streaming video instead of just streaming audio, that can eat through a data plan far faster than, say, Spotify or Google Play Music.
Right. So we have a situation here where we have Google Play Music, which is still a prominent but not really not really well talked about, well trafficked streaming music service from Google that has a free tier, and it has a free music library feature that you like and many other people still use, and there's a $10 a month kind of all access streaming package like there is for Spotify and Apple Music and Deezer and all the others. And then on the YouTube Music side, the free version is not really a great product, but the premium version is something quite interesting, right? You've talked a lot about this, and I think it's fascinating because Google is trying to position it as a separate product to Play Music, but it's not really there yet. It's not worth the $10 a month to spend on its own. And yet, I think Google is positioning YouTube Music to eventually replace Play Music as its flagship streaming music service.
Yes, and YouTube executives have said that they intend to migrate Google Play Music, its features, and its libraries over to YouTube Music over the next couple of years. It's obviously not ready for that quite yet, because we need feature parity between Google Play Music and YouTube Music before that can happen. But they have said that the most important feature of Google Play Music, that 50,000 song music locker, is going to migrate over to YouTube Music, which means that not only are you going to have the largest catalog in the world for music, the largest video catalog in the world to pull from, if you can't find something on that, you're going to be able to upload it yourself to YouTube Music, which means that you are going to be able to listen to literally anything on this service.
Okay, so now we've sort of laid the groundwork for where we are in terms of Google streaming music catalog. It's not quite as confusing as the messaging, you know, the messaging business, but it's close.
Yeah.
Jerry, what's your take on the positioning in general around streaming music and Google? You know, this is a company that has, as Aris said, more people listening to music on YouTube than people listening to music on Spotify, right?
Right.
And yet the company is struggling to convert those people into paying users, into paying customers, both on Google Play Music and on this new service. But is it the right strategy to go all in on YouTube Music and YouTube Premium?
Maybe. Google, they technically have a great product. I think we all can agree that YouTube, despite its weird flaws sometimes, is a great product. But I don't think about a paid service. YouTube TV, YouTube Premium, YouTube Red. I hear all these paid services that I can buy through YouTube. But maybe because I've been using YouTube for so long, I don't associate it with any type of paid service. I don't know if that's going to be a bit of a disconnect where people don't, you know, instantly think about YouTube for a streaming service when there's Spotify. You know, that's just a guess. They've got to do something. It's clear they can't lose this market. They just can't give it away. So they have to do something, and I'm going to guess that they've thought a whole lot about this. And I just don't know, Daniel. I don't have the answers here. I'm confused. I feel terrible.
You feel terrible. If you feel terrible, then YouTube's executive and management team probably feels even worse. So
I opened YouTube and I see it says premium up in the corner. I'm bad with money. I don't know how much I pay a month. I know I see YouTube Premium, politics, 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 Splinter Cell for some crazy reason. And if I scroll way, way, way down the page, I see some music videos and some recommended and suggestions. I didn't even know those were down there.
Okay, so Ara, take us through YouTube Premium, because this is sort of the evolution of YouTube Red, and it also coincides with Google's push into original content on YouTube. So for $12 a month, you get YouTube ad-free, you get all this original content, and you get free access to YouTube Music Premium and Google Play Music All Access or Premium or whatever it's called these days, unlimited, with all those features. And you say that that continues to be a great deal, but it's basically like a value add, right? You get, you know, if on the one hand, you're encouraging people to pay $2 or more per month for something or for a bunch of services that they may not use, but it's sort of like a Costco membership or something. You buy it so that you can have it. You just want the ability to buy things, to get more things cheaper. Or more like a Prime membership, actually, if the digital analog makes more sense. So what is your take on YouTube Premium, and is YouTube Music Premium or YouTube Music itself just part of the package?
That's actually the best description of it, honestly, because if you just buy YouTube Music Premium, you only get access to one app, YouTube Music. If you buy Google Play Music, you get access to two apps. You get access to Google Play Music and YouTube Music. If you buy YouTube Premium, you get Google Play Music, YouTube Music, and then you also get the premium features on YouTube, YouTube Kids, YouTube Gaming, and YouTube VR. So that's six apps with premium features for $12, which is $2 an app for premium features. So even if you don't use YouTube Gaming very much or YouTube VR very much, you're still probably getting a world's worth of value out of this, because we all watch YouTube videos. Like, that is like the, it's the standard place to find music videos. It's the standard place to find most of our video content. I don't have cable anymore, but I can watch Daily Show through YouTube. I watch Full Frontal through YouTube since I don't have cable, so I don't have TBS. But for YouTube Premium, it's, yeah, people have used it for free for so long. But I think the biggest problem that YouTube has had with getting people to pay for it is that most people didn't know that YouTube Red exists, because they see any kind of like pop-up of, oh, hey, try this service, and they immediately click away from it. Because that's our basic instinct at this point. Because it's like, oh, we use YouTube free for so long, why would we pay for this? But paying for it offers up things that people really, really want. People listen to YouTube for music in the car, and I want people to pay for that so they can turn the screen off and not get distracted by a music video or whatever else in it. And offline playback would save users money because they could stream less over data. And more importantly, by contributing to YouTube Premium, Google has to resort to fewer and fewer crap ads, and that's more guaranteed revenue for both YouTube and the content creators.
It is interesting to me, though. You know, I understand Amazon's strategy around Prime, right? You get people to spend $100 a year on Prime, and you give them a whole bunch of stuff, including one-day shipping, all this original content, music, you know, games, Twitch, all these value adds. But their business model is really just to sell you more stuff, and they make margins on the products. And the other stuff they can give away because of the money that they make selling, you know, physical goods and the partnerships they have with all the distributors. Google is an ad company. I mean, Google makes the vast majority of its ads from pre-roll ads on YouTube videos, on AdSense ads when you search for something, double-click ads when you go to another website. There are all of these products that Google has in its repertoire that makes billions of dollars every quarter. And yet, YouTube is encouraging people to spend $12 a month to see no ads at all on YouTube, right? This is counter... You can't pay to see no ads on Google, right? You can't pay to hear, you know, like there's really no comparison to the core Google properties. Jerry, what do you take on this?
Well, they were going to try. You could pay not to see Google ads. Remember, they...
Yep, Google contributor.
They rolled it out. You know, we're going to try this slow. And then it kind of just died off. So that makes your point even more, you know, pointful that they decided not to go that far with YouTube or with Google ads across the web, but yet they're doing it on YouTube, which is universally popular. So I don't understand the economics. I'm not very good on economic ideas to start with, but I'm going to guess that the number of people that are willing to pay $12 right now is not putting much of a dent in the number of ads that are getting seen.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I'm sure that the $12 number offsets the value of the ads that people are seeing, or at least most people won't sit through an entire pre-roll. So the amount of money that creators are getting or brands are getting is probably more per click when you have a premium subscription.
I hope so.
Than you would for just a free user seeing a pre-roll ad.
I would hope so, and I think if that's the case, YouTube needs to let us know that, because I would be more willing to pay, you know, for a premium service knowing that some of that money trickles down.
Yeah, I mean, YouTube does have a creator program, and once you're opted into that, you do get a cut of YouTube Premium's revenue. I mean, that's the whole idea, especially with the original content. And Ara, we see this now with shows like Cobra Kai, with some of the upcoming shows that are trying to dip their toe into the same realm as Netflix and Amazon and Hulu with their original content. Do you see that alone as being reason enough to spend $12 a month for YouTube Premium?
Well, for premium content, I don't see the premium content on YouTube as being worth $12, just because I'm sorry, I've been a YouTube Red subscriber for as long as I've been a YouTube Red. And Jerry, by the way, if you don't know what you're paying for Google Play Music, chances are you were one of those early adopters that got in for $8 a month, and you're still paying $8 a month for what is now $12 a month.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the first day, Phil said, Jerry, you need to do this, and I said, okay.
Yeah, so you're paying $8 a month for it, which means you've saved like $200 over the last 5 years. Woo-hoo. For YouTube Red. Woohoo!
Terry, if you're listening, I get to spend $200 now.
Happy to help you, Jerry. Premium content encourages users to watch more things on YouTube and share more things on YouTube. And the more active users are on YouTube and the more people are sharing videos, the more engagement YouTube gets, which might be more valuable to them than that them watching 3 seconds of a pre-roll ad and then clicking next. It's also clear from YouTube Red and from YouTube Premium that at least some of that subscription fee is going to content creators. I don't know if it's going to all content creators or just... I know part of it now is going to the record labels whenever you watch music videos. That has been an agreement that they have had over the last couple of years with when they started negotiating with labels for YouTube Music. But some of it also has to go to YouTube creators, because if they're going to push YouTube Premium and YouTube Red on people and then say, oh yeah, by the way, creators don't get any ad revenue from this, you just get to watch it for free, that wouldn't fly. So we don't know if the conversion rate is the same for a creator if somebody watches it with an ad or if somebody watches it with YouTube Premium. But we also know that a lot of people have ad blockers, because ad blockers are almost required on a lot of sites that end up having weird or buggy ads across the internet. And there are people who will watch YouTube and strip off the ads, and that just means that YouTube doesn't get any money for it, and the content creator doesn't get any money for it because an ad was never played. And YouTube is like, okay, we want you to pay for YouTube Premium, so that way we make sure content creators are getting the money and we are getting the money, so that way we can so that way we don't have to offer up bad ads that people don't like.
So let's talk a little bit about YouTube Music, the product, okay? So Google Play Music is a known quantity. Ara, you've talked about its deficiencies for years and how it, in many ways, it's still a better product than Spotify and all the other streaming music services. But in a lot of ways, it's not. In some ways, it's actually quite a lot worse. When you look at YouTube Music, it seems like a very different strategy to play music. And it's a lot right now simpler. There's a lot fewer features. And while we know that some of the Play Music features will eventually get ported over, I think that this is Google putting sort of a much simpler spin on the idea of streaming in general. And I don't know if it'll ever be as complex and as feature filled as Play Music. Is that the point here? And what is your take right now on the overall kind of the overall quality of Google of YouTube Music in comparison to the other big ones out there?
Well, right now, yes, YouTube Music is somewhat feature light. That means it's easier to find what is there, but there's still some holes in the content library that are being filled out, especially in regards to official content, because YouTube Music and Google Play Music, they're both owned by Google, so everybody thinks, oh, these are going to have the same licensing agreements with the record deal. So if I can find something on Google Play Music, I can find it on YouTube Music, and that just isn't the case right now because they are two separate products and they have separate record label deals. And one of the reasons that YouTube Music might not get music as quickly or as readily as Google Play Music is that any music that is available on YouTube Music is available on regular YouTube, meaning it's available for free to people who are willing to watch YouTube with ads. So, for instance, the latest Beyoncé album, it was on Tidal for 2 days exclusively, and then it was on Spotify and Google Play Music and Apple Music for like 2 or 3 days. And then it appeared on YouTube Music, because once it appeared on YouTube Music, anybody could watch it for free.
But, interesting.
Yeah, because, and that's something that people are having a hard time figuring out, why things are available on YouTube Music, but aren't available on YouTube Music, but they are available on Google Play Music. And that's because Google Play, yeah, they have a free service, but it's hard to like watch a specific song or album or video on the free tier, because the free tier of Google Play Music for subscription content is Shuffle Play. But then we also have the music, the music locker service for Google Play Music is kind of invaluable, because yeah, it's free and 50,000 songs, but Google Play Music is by far the easiest platform for allowing users to mix uploaded content, your music locker, your personal music with subscription music, which is why it was basically the only choice for me, because the only other service that even comes close to doing that would be iTunes with the iCloud music syncing, but that doesn't really work outside of Apple devices, and I don't have any Apple devices.
So here's what's interesting to me. When you open YouTube Music right now, you get three bottom tabs. You get home, you get hot list, and you get library. So on others like YouTube, or on even on Play Music, but on Spotify, for instance, that's a lot busier. You get browse, you get sort of a personalized list of playlists. You get a full catalog of all the new releases for that week. You get a whole bunch of categories. You know, you can filter your playlists or your albums by, or a radio station by the way that you're feeling, or a certain mood by by your location. I mean, there's so much granularity to all of these streaming music services. But here, you just see three tabs. You get sort of this random but contextual list of playlists that YouTube Music has put together. I see The Wedge, 90s. This is some Canadian stuff. Rap City. I see some, you know, I've listened to some Father John Misty recently, so it says similar to Father John Misty. And I see a whole bunch of artists, The Shins, Sufjan Stevens. And then I can actually subscribe, which is the same nomenclature that you would find on YouTube, to these artists rather than follow. When you Spotify, you follow an artist. On YouTube, you subscribe to an artist. And then when I go over to Hotlist, I actually see music videos. It's a video Hotlist rather than just a collection of streaming playlists. And I find that to be really interesting, that videos are still so prominent in this app, that they really do want you to spend time listening to music, yes, but watching music videos. What's your take on that?
Well, most people don't really use the Hotlist, because the Hotlist is basically the trending music videos page from the main YouTube app. These are the music videos that are being watched the most, being streamed the most, these are the ones that are viral. These are the ones that everybody else is watching. But for most users, either you've already seen these videos because they came up through your mixtape or through your suggestions, or somebody sent you this video when it first came out because, oh, this is the new music video from such and such artist. This is the new Cardi B music video. So Hotlist isn't as useful right now as a tab, as opposed to like browsing or genres. And several users have said that we want to see a genre tab in here, so that way it's easier to find music without having to rely on contextual recommendations or search. The home tab right now is very much like Spotify's home tab, in that there's some suggested playlists based on topics. There's suggested artists based on what you've listened to, and then you have your mixtape, which is the version of YouTube Music's algorithm-based radio station, similar to the daily mixes on Spotify, except instead of having three or four genre-based radio stations, you have one radio station that you'll hear everything in.
Right. I mean, it definitely speaks to this idea of diversity, of music diversity with YouTube. I will listen to If I just go on YouTube itself and I start listening to a whole bunch of music videos or music in general, the breadth of content is going to be much wider. The variety is going to be much bigger than if I were to do the same on Spotify, which generally sticks to a particular type of music, a particular genre. Or if I have an artist radio station, it doesn't give me only that artist, but it gives me that artist and very similar artists to him or her. This is still encouraging you to be as diverse a music consumer as possible. Jerry, when you listen to when you look into this interface, or you think about the way that YouTube is approaching music, sort of as an autoplay first product, why do you think that is the strategy, and will it work for this product in particular?
Yeah, for most people, I think it'll work. Almost everybody is okay with finding a song they like on the radio, those still exist, and then getting busy and letting the radio play even though they don't know what the next song is going to be. And Google is capable of tailoring, you know, a playlist of what you like. I wish they did a better job. I mean, they know everything I buy, everything I listen to. Some of their recommendations really boggle my mind. But I see why they're going, because nobody else can do it. If Google can pull this off, that's something that Spotify, that, you know, they do a fair job. I imagine iTunes does a fair job after you've used the service for a while. But Google can conglomerate everything you've listened to that you're willing to share and know better what you want to hear than anybody else. So I think that's a good call for them if they can pull it off. You know, they've got big ambitions for a lot of their products, Google does, and sometimes they work. I want to mention about the UI, though. They've got a wonderful HTML5 app at music.youtube.com. If you look at that through, you know, Chrome or any modern internet browser, and then look at the app, there's no reason to use the app. Throw the app away. Because it's so much better on the web. And that I don't understand.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, there is no app on for desktop right now.
No.
And that
there probably won't be.
That probably won't be. I mean, there's an unofficial app that's been making its rounds, but I don't think Google wants people to have a native app for anything. It's, you know, this is its Chrome strategy. Everything right. needs to be optimized for the web. Ara, when you compare the state of YouTube Music, or where you think YouTube Music will be in a year with the features that it'll have, Jerry, I literally just spilt the same water bottle on my desk again. I can't
That's
believe
Aquaman's
I did that.
MacBook.
Unbelievable. Sorry. I got to stop flailing my arms when I podcast. This is terrible. So where do you see YouTube Music in a year compared to where Google Play Music is now? Like, do you think that they will just reach feature parity and YouTube Music will take over, or will this still be a distinct product even once Google Play Music disappears?
I think Google Play Music has been around since 2011, or I think since 2011 or 2010. I've used it since the end of 2011 because free 50,000 song Music Locker was all I ever needed to hear before I jumped into Google Play Music, before it was even a subscription music service. But Google Play Music just hasn't been marketed well. Most people don't know what Google Play Music is. Most people just think, oh, it's that free music app that comes on your phone, and then they'll open it and go, oh, it's not free, because Google doesn't highlight the Music Locker service unless you're on desktop, because you can't upload to your Music Locker from Android. You have to do it from a Chromebook or a Windows or an Apple computer. And as a result, Google Play Music has just kind of been like, we don't really know what this is. We don't really know why Google wants us to pay for something that came on our phone. And Google Play Music has had a device limit that many people can run into, because Once you authorize a device for Google Play Music, it stays authorized forever. Even if you get rid of the phone, it'll still be an authorized device on Google Play Music until you go into your account settings and turn it off. And you can only turn off 4 devices in a year still. Which is part of why, like, especially for tech reviewers, we switch phones a whole lot. So Google Play Music never made a whole lot of sense for us because we run into that limit and we're just like, okay, we can't use this. YouTube Music doesn't have a device limit because YouTube doesn't have a device limit. That's not the way that they do authorizations. So it'll be... YouTube Music is great because you're going to be able to listen to it just about anywhere, because anywhere that you can listen to YouTube, you can listen to YouTube Music. Which means that even though Spotify Connect brings your music like to freaking all of the speakers everywhere, YouTube Music is still going to be easier to access more places because you can just open YouTube and find your music library. Well, parts of your music library, because right now they're separating out YouTube Music's library function, especially the albums and the art, albums and the watch history from the main YouTube history, which we wanted, but we still need to be able to access it through the main YouTube app somewhere. And that's still being worked on.
Okay. But so sorry to interrupt, but I just want to say, like, the features that you're talking about, the locker, the free streaming, I mean, these are business models that are being left behind by the competitors, right? Nobody, aside from Spotify, which is still really pushing that $10 a month subscription, very few companies are doubling down on free. I mean, it's so expensive for the for these companies to pay the labels for music licenses that they really just want as many people paying for monthly subscriptions as possible to offset those high fees. And as a result, the music locker, the device authorizations, I mean, these are not really modern ideas, right? They're largely going by the wayside. Google Play Music All Access or Unlimited or whatever it is now, that's, you know, as a holistic, you know, premium streaming music service, it's pretty good, right? I mean, there's very little that you would say it's missing compared to Spotify, right?
Yeah, Google Play Music is a music service that has podcasts. It has more podcasts than Spotify because uploading podcasts for Google Play Music is easier than it is for Spotify. It has, it has a larger music library, and it has a catalog that you can augment yourself, because not only can you upload music, you can purchase music from Google as well. So say the Anastasia Cash recording isn't available for streaming through the subscription library, I can just go to Google Play, buy the album, and import it in. And I do that with musical soundtracks a lot, because if I want to listen to something, I want to listen to something. I don't care if I have to pay for the actual album and import it in. I want to listen to what I want to listen to. And on Spotify, if you don't have it, you don't have it, because you can't add anything to that, which is why the music locker coming from Google Play Music to YouTube Music is going to be so important, because and purchases from Google Play Music are going to be going to YouTube Music as well. So if something isn't available on this gigantic, biggest music video platform in the world, you're going to be able to buy it if it's available to purchase. And if it's not available to purchase, you're going to be able to upload it yourself.
Right. Okay. So that is where things stand today. Google is clearly not interested in Play Music. At least it isn't as interested in it as it used to be. Jerry, do you see a time where Google Play Music just disappears and YouTube Music and YouTube Premium is the only streaming music option for Google customers?
I bet we'll see some sort of Google survey product to find out how many people are attached to the words Play Music, and that will be the decider. Google doesn't care about the branding. It just didn't get enough traction to be something they can't get rid of. They'll pick whatever they think will play better to new users. Existing users, they don't need to catch. They've already got us.
Okay, so Google, I mean, it's interesting, right? Because Google is sort of, they're not really interested in holding on to brands if they're not working. And we've seen this with others as well. I mean, Android Pay became Google Pay. The Android Wear became Wear OS. They're attaching the name Google to a lot of things, but they're not really making a big deal about what things are called. I think, as Ara mentioned earlier, it was a marketing problem with Play Music, right? People didn't know that you could spend $11 or $10 a month on Play Music Unlimited and that the product was as good as it is. It never got the attention that Spotify has. And in fact, it's really quite low on the totem pole. I mean, if you think about the top streaming music services, you think, in the US at least, you think Spotify and Apple Music as premium, and then you think of Pandora as the sort of free tier, right? Even though Pandora has an unlimited tier now because they bought RDO, RIP. And even that, right, Pandora Premium isn't doing as well as we would like it to be. So
Pandora has had to pull out of every country except the US, and in the US they're losing subscribers left and right. Pandora, I don't think, is going to be around much longer.
So is it just that it's a saturated market and there aren't enough customers to go around? Do companies like Google need to add value to existing streaming music services in order to keep them leveraged? Because you see this with Spotify to some extent. Spotify is doubling down on podcasts. It's getting into original content. Right now, when I open Spotify, I see an Amy Schumer podcast that is exclusive to Spotify, or at least there's like bonus content that's exclusive to Spotify. The company's working with a lot of original creators to create original podcasts. It's got the Spotify singles category that where artists and musicians come in and they record specifically for the Spotify catalog. And we have like Broad City, for instance, is creating content for Spotify that will live on the service. So we see Spotify dipping its toe into original content, into video as well, right?
Apple Music has had original content too for as long as there's been an Apple Music, because they relate to the game and they needed something to help differentiate them, because even the Apple brand was not quite enough for Apple Music to compete with Spotify. But for original content, all of the services are doing that now. Google Play Music has had exclusive content. It's just not as highly publicized. YouTube Music already has exclusive content. Panic at the Disco did a live session and YouTube streamed it for YouTube Music. And they've been highlighting new and original content through social all week and all month. Spotify has had original content for a little while. They're trying to double down on it because Spotify is seeing increased competition because, YouTube Music is going to cut into their bottom line because you can get more things on YouTube Music than you can on Spotify. And even if they don't have podcasts, they're going to have all of that music. And then for other content of that ilk, some of it you can get on YouTube Music and then the rest of it is available on YouTube. And since you already follow the artist on YouTube Music, all of that content will be waiting for you in the main YouTube app, regardless of if you're a YouTube Premium or YouTube Music Premium subscriber.
So, Jerry, even though you're paying for the ability not to see ads on YouTube and not hear ads on YouTube Music, how much of this is a recommendations play, is a data play for Google? I mean, this is giving Google a treasure trove of information about you, right? What artists you like to listen to, what music you enjoy, what you search for on YouTube.
The data this gives Google is probably, worth more than the revenue that they're making for the subscription fees, because it can tie into everything else. It's just another tool they can use to paint that, detailed picture of who you are.
And I mean, we do know that YouTube exists as an independent company within Google.
Right.
But how much is this going to affect the other Google services that you use on a regular basis?
They're all covered under the same general data agreement at their base. I'm pretty sure YouTube still has its own user, you know, policies, but the Google, you know, the Google privacy policies also apply underneath that. So anything you share through YouTube goes back to the Borg.
Right. The Borg.
Well, okay. Yeah, because you can still curate and see everything that YouTube has on you through the My Activity page, just right. like you would for Google Search or right. Google Drive or whatever.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the top layer, any YouTube agreements would be more, they have to do special regional things for their licensing with record labels and stuff. I think that's where that would be covered. But as far as data privacy, what you share, how you share it, and the rules under which you share it, that's the Google general privacy policy.
So YouTube just announced something called alternative monetization, where they will allow creators to charge $5 a month for channel memberships, which is basically a way for creators to get additional revenue. If a creator has more than 100,000 customer or subscribers and they are members of YouTube's partner program, they can charge a monthly recurring fee of $5 that gives viewers the ability to sport tier badges, members-only posts in the community tab, unique perks that are offered by the creators, such as exclusive live streams, extra videos that aren't available to the wider audience, unique shout-outs, things like that. This is taking on Twitch directly.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
taking on Patreon indirectly because Patreon and YouTube have a sort of synergistic relationship. But this also kind of goes with this idea of like tipping your creators, making sure that YouTube creators are getting the revenue that they deserve, especially in light of all the demonetization issues that YouTube has been dealing with, or creators have been dealing with on behalf of YouTube and YouTube advertisers. Ara, is YouTube just too chaotic to have a curated normal, quote, normal streaming music service?
No. Because, I mean, I've been an avid YouTube user for years, but it was very, very easy for me to get a normal feed in YouTube Music. I had that within 3 days. And for people who they log into YouTube Music for the first time and it's all music videos, that's because that's all of the that's the entire history that YouTube has to work with you right now. Once you start listening to regular songs and regular albums, that will fill up your recommendations in your home tab very, very quickly. So no, I don't think YouTube is too chaotic for a regular streaming service, especially through the YouTube Music app, because the YouTube Music app doesn't fall into a lot of the same chaos that the regular YouTube app does. And they have said that one of the things that users have asked for YouTube Music and are going to get is, right now you can only subscribe to standard artists. You can't subscribe to regular YouTube content creators in YouTube Music. That is coming soon. So you're going to be able to, if you follow some up-and-comer who they're just a regular YouTube creator, but they upload like covers or mashups, or they're an artist of some kind, you're going to be able to subscribe to them in YouTube Music and see all of their new content there, not just in the YouTube app. So I see YouTube, I don't think YouTube is as chaotic as they are. I do think that the alternative monetization is going to be good news, especially for YouTube accounts with a high following, because relying on monetization for your videos means that for any sort of channel that regularly does any sort of adult content or even halfway controversial content, that means that they are going to at least get some revenue from these videos, since almost all of them get flagged for demonetization immediately, and appealing the demonetization ruling takes time. So I do see this being a popular service, especially with as many gamers are migrating to YouTube gaming as opposed to Twitch, because Twitch has been cracking down hardcore on streamers for, I want to say, the last 12 to 18 months now. So people have been leaving Twitch and coming to YouTube gaming because YouTube gaming isn't quite as strict about content and policing streamers.
I mean, that's probably not something that they should be proud of, but okay, well, fair enough.
Yeah, YouTube still, the algorithm, it takes the final call, whereas Twitch, it's easy for you and 20 friends to get a streamer banned.
Yep, and it takes weeks to get unbanned if you get unbanned at all. So Twitch is one of those places of, it's very easy to build up a following, but it's also very easy to lose everything because somebody decided to be an asshole and ban you.
And that's a problem for Twitch, and YouTube is just benefiting from it.
Okay, so we're sort of approaching the hour mark here. I want to wind down this conversation and just talk a little bit about YouTube Music in the context of Spotify. You know, Spotify has the most paid subscribers in the U.S. It's got the most free subscribers in the world. It's got generally accepted to be the best overall user experience, although I will disagree on that because I actually don't think Spotify is a very user-friendly experience at all. Then there's Apple Music, which has no free tier. It's just a three-month free trial, and then you have to pay. There are others that are very popular around the world, like Deezer. There's still Slacker Radio. There's still, or Slacker now it's called. There is Pandora, as we said. There's Google Play Music and YouTube Music. And of course, there's Tidal, which is has a $10 tier, but it really does focus on either exclusive content, like what we saw with the Carters last week, or high quality, lossless, or higher quality lossless audio for double the cost, $20 a month. So sorry, Jerry, go ahead.
I'm going to assume that, Era, you might know, Clear Channel has some sort of streaming service. They have to, don't they?
I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure that they do, but I'm not familiar with it, mostly because I'm not a huge radio fan. I will say that while we're talking about audio quality, that's the one area where YouTube Music is at a clear disadvantage right now, because any other music streaming service you have, at the very least, you have low quality, medium quality, high quality for your audio. All the audio in YouTube Music right now is capped at, I think it's 128 kilobit per second, because they haven't added the robust audio quality settings that they really need to for this. Because a lot of audio files, it's like, oh, cool, this has amazing selection. And then they're logging in and they're seeing the audio quality is crap, and they're just writing it off forever and going back to Tidal or Deezer, because those are the two high quality streaming services right now. I will say that Tidal's app is very well laid out and it's very clean, because while we want to add value to music subscription radio, Clear Channel streaming service, by the way, is iHeartRadio.
Yeah,
and
I
they have
that
plugins
up too.
For TuneIn.
So I was thinking that they were poised to make some sort of huge predatory leap, but no, iHeartRadio has been around forever.
And iHeartRadio, I think, went bankrupt a little while ago.
They did, yeah. Well, not bankrupt. I think they just filed for Chapter 11.
Yeah.
Which is bankruptcy, but I mean, it's not like they're not. I think it's still running. I just don't think they're.
Yeah, iHeartRadio is still running. But for YouTube Music compared to Spotify, Spotify is a more polished app because Spotify will be 10 years old in October, which is a mind-blowing thing to think about. So they've had a long time to build up their service and polish their app. Although, Bader, I will agree with you, the user experience on Spotify isn't as good as other platforms, because, especially on Android, because Android is just not as big of a priority for Spotify, it seems. There are bugs in Spotify for Android that were quashed years ago for iOS devices. You still can't edit playlists properly on Android the way that you can on Apple devices. And queue management on Spotify has always just been odd to me. But it has a big collection of content. But the other reason that Spotify has managed to build the empire that it was, apart from being, well, really first, was Spotify has the best student streaming subscription on the market, because it's $5 a month and it gets you Spotify Premium and Hulu. And for anybody in college, that's kind of a no-brainer. And once you've been on Spotify for 3 years, the prospect of having to migrate to something else is just completely unappealing to anybody, because migrating between music services is just like pulling teeth. I've had to rebuild my library twice in the last 6 months. Once when I was reviewing Spotify for Android Central, and again when YouTube Music launched. Because while your Google Play Music might be coming to YouTube Music in the future, it's not there right now, which means you have to build your library over again if you want to use YouTube Music right now.
Okay, so in conclusion, would you recommend people subscribe to YouTube Music right now? Or moreover, would you recommend that people get YouTube Music through YouTube Premium and that can live alone as their sole streaming music option?
I believe YouTube Premium is the best value for streaming music, because you get two apps for the price of one, and then you get two music apps for the price of one, and then you get YouTube on top of it. So I would not recommend buying YouTube Music on its own, because YouTube Music on its own only gets you access in one app. If you just want the music experience on Google, subscribe to Google Play Music, so that way you get Google Play Music and YouTube Music. But subscribing to YouTube Music by itself doesn't make sense, because it's the same $10 that Google Play Music is without access to the other app.
Wait, so you can subscribe to Google Play Music and get YouTube Music, but you can't subscribe to YouTube Music and get Google Play Music?
That is correct.
That makes no sense.
No, it does not, but that's what it is. And that's part of why, if you're going to pay YouTube for anything, pay for YouTube Premium, not Music Premium.
Okay. And the YouTube Premium is available in now 17 countries, including the US, Australia, New Zealand, Mexico, South Korea, which are the five launch markets for YouTube Music and YouTube Red. Plus, recently, Canada, the UK, Ireland, Germany, Austria, France, Italy, Spain, Russia, Sweden, Norway, and Finland. That's a pretty big, you know, pretty wide variety of places. And, you know, I think it hits a lot of Google's biggest markets. And I wouldn't be surprised to see it launch in many other markets before the end of 2018. So, we're going to stop there for music talk. We're going to take a quick break and we're going to thank our sponsor, Thrifter. Thrifter is the place to go for all of your favorite deals. And in the run-up to Prime Day, Thrifter is the only place that you need to know about for your Prime Day newsletter. You can get you'll get a newsletter in your inbox whenever there are big deals announced. You can also get deals that Amazon's putting out pre-Prime Day to prime you for Prime Day, and a lot of other cool things if you get to thrifter.com. So as we do every week, we are going to go around and pick a deal that we like from the homepage. And because you haven't been here for a while, Ara, I will start with you. What's your recommendation?
Alrighty, well, it is Texas, and we had our fifth triple-digit temperature yesterday, I believe. Yesterday or Sunday.
Man. That's brutal.
I mean, it's not as bad as it could be. Back in 2011, we'd already had 15 triple-digit days by this point. We've only had five so far, so I'm happy it's as low as it is. But because it is hot, I don't want to leave my Nest thermostat at like 75 degrees in the mornings when I'm home. I want to be able to set it on eco and save a little bit more money. And also because I forget to set my thermostat higher when I leave for work sometimes. So I need a fan to just kind of blow a little bit of air circulation on me while I'm working in the mornings. And I see that today Thrifter has a little deal on a USB rechargeable portable fan. So I think that's going to be my little indulgence for the day, because for $9 for a small tabletop sized fan that will charge over the same micro USB that most of my Bluetooth headphones use, that'll work.
It's actually a really adorable little fan. It's called eFluky.
Yeah, I had to scroll down and find it. It's even blue.
They have a blue one, and then they have a black one that's black and blue. So I'm debating which color I want.
Oh, the blue and white. Come on.
I'm so surprised you didn't pick the Funko version of Disney's Jafar.
I've never been a big Funko fan. I'm not sure why, but it just doesn't appeal to me quite as much.
So not every Disney product is worth buying.
Well, I mean, it's a cute Funko. I've just never been a big fan of Funko, period. I'm not a big fan of the black eyes.
This is the first time I've ever heard of Funko, to be honest. I've seen them before, but I didn't know what the brand was. So now I'm on their Amazon page, and there are a lot.
Oh, don't do it. It's a black hole.
It's seriously, there's a Rick and Morty one.
They just announced their exclusives for San Diego Comic-Con. Because that's, of course, something that they have for San Diego Comic-Con. But they're always, most of them are adorable. But I just know that if I started, I wouldn't be able to stop. And I have enough addictions in my life.
Yeah, I'm looking at this Bob Ross one. He's holding a paintbrush and a palette. And it's adorable. So I may have to get it. Jerry, what is your pick for this supplemental ACP?
Unlike Era, my wife and I will sell plasma to be able to afford to keep that AC on 75 when it's that hot. So I'm not looking at a fan. I found a little bitty, I'm going to call it portable. It's looks like a power strip UPS for $35. And as someone who just lost a gaming PC that I considered one of my children from a lightning strike.
No.
Yeah. Well, this was a few months back. I don't know if you remember when I came in crying.
Yeah, I do.
The one I've rebuilt is still going strong, and it's got two UPSs running it. Do yourself a favor and make sure anything that can get burnt up by lightning or overvoltage is plugged into a UPS. Do not learn the way I learned. And it's $35, and it's 330 watts. It would probably run a small desktop, but it's perfect for your laptop, your Chromebook, heck, your phone charger. You do not want lightning to hit anywhere around your yard, because the things plugged into your sockets in your house, if they aren't protected, will go bzzz.
And do as Jerry says, not as he does. Or at least do as Jerry says and does now, not as he did.
Oh, no. You see, the thing, I had it on a UPS, and the batteries weren't charging correctly, and I got tired of every 50 minutes it would go, meh, meh. So I hit the button and disabled the UPS. I'm going to get batteries, and then it was just a matter of a couple weeks, and I still hadn't gotten batteries, and boom.
So I'm gonna pull the obvious one here. It's both super trendy and it's Canadian. I'm gonna talk about the Instant Pot. It's a 6-quart Instant Pot Duo Plus for $90. That's $40 off the retail price. Instant Pot is, if you are under a rock and haven't heard of this, it's a take on the pressure cooker, but it has a lot of settings and, you know, a few particular amenities built in that make it a little bit nicer than the average pressure cooker. It's also a lot cheaper than some bigger pressure cookers, and it's just the hottest kitchen gadget you can buy right now. And we always see sales for this on Amazon, but this is a really good one. This is their sort of double speed, super simple version of the Instant Pot, the Duo Plus. And it's 6 quarts, so it's not huge, but it's big enough for the average, you know, meal, a family of four type of thing. And it'll get the job done. For $90, I think you can't really go wrong here. So that is my selection. Do either of you use an Instant Pot?
Yes, my wife has one. And, you know, up until right now, I assumed it was like a crock pot. I had no idea it was a pressure cooker.
Well, it's both. It can be both, but it's got pressure cooker.
Yeah,
it's basically a slow cooker, pressure cooker, rice cooker, yogurt maker, built in.
I didn't know it. I see the pressure release valve and the clamping hood. Those are expensive.
Yeah,
I didn't know.
That's why this has been so damn popular.
But I think that size is the one that we bought. I know we didn't get the biggest one. We bought it at Target and spent way too much money.
Yeah, as you do. All right. Well, if you're interested in learning more, go to thrifter.com and check them out. All right. So for the last few minutes, this ACPS, We're going to talk about the Time Warner AT&T merger slash insane deal. Jerry, I'm going to defer to you on this. This has been a long time coming. This has been going through the courts for over a year now, right? And part of the reason for the delay is that the Justice Department sued AT&T over concerns that the deal would lower competition and that it wouldn't be good for the U.S. market. Even though this is it's a vertical merger, which means that there aren't any competitors being eliminated from the market. Time Warner is not a direct competitor of AT&T. Time Warner is a content maker and distributor, and AT&T is a telecom. It builds networks. So what was the concern, though, and why did it sort of take so long to actually get completed?
A way that I've heard being used to get people to understand this. Imagine if Netflix, they're a service we all know and love, and we know exactly what they do. They provide videos we can watch. Imagine if they were able to buy Comcast. Switch this around, and you have a company who does nothing but produce media that they want to distribute online, and they now own the means to control the distribution of it online. And, you know, I'm not going to say that they're going to try to hurt the competition, but they have the capability to hurt the competition all at the same time. And that's just a dangerous precedent. If you don't go any further than that, having one board of directors at the helm that controls the media that gets distributed and the distribution channel is not wise for competition.
So this is not unprecedented, right?
No.
Verizon owns its own version of Time Warner. In Yahoo / AOL, it is also looking to be the owner of content as well as a network, both physical and wireless. Mm-hmm. We know that famously the AOL Time Warner merger fizzled and it was basically a disaster. The cultures within Time Warner didn't understand the culture within AOL. They never really worked out. Then Time Warner was once again spun off. Time Warner also used to own Time Inc., which was the magazine company, an enormous presence in the media world. In the printed media landscape until very recently. So this company has an enormous legacy, right, of building content. It owns TBS, it owns CNN, it owns famously HBO, which is an enormous, I keep saying enormous, it's a very big quill in AT&T's cap here, because AT&T then is now allowed, through the death of net neutrality, to zero rate all of the content that it owns, right? So talk us through this. AT&T just launched something called Watch TV. It's a streaming music bundle that competes with YouTube TV and, you know, PlayStation and DirecTV. Well, not DirecTV now, but all these other over-the-top ones. Sling, thank you.
PS View.
Doesn't Turner Broadcasting own Hulu?
No. But they may have a stake in it. So,
okay,
let's talk about that. So, AT&T is now able to make its own content free over the airwaves and still charge customers for the same experience with Netflix or any other competitor. What does that say about the way that AT&T is positioning this purchase?
Well, let's be frank and honest. We are going to see, zero-rated HBO Go on your AT&T smartphone top-tier plan for your iPhone or Galaxy device in the end of 2018. I guarantee it. They're stupid not to do it now that they are able to. They control the supply chain from start to finish. Heck, they even control, you know, DC Entertainment through Warner Brothers. They can even make the content and distribute it and use their own bandwidth. They're crazy not to do that for you. That's going to hurt Netflix because they're not going to do the same for Netflix unless Netflix pays them to do it. You know, Netflix can afford to be hurt a little bit. But what about, you know, another great, what's it, Crunchyroll? People love Crunchyroll. Or, you know, there's plenty of smaller streaming services that have great quality content that, you know, most people have never heard of. You're never going to hear of them if they get put out because, you know, one third of the American public has to pay to watch them when they don't have to pay to watch HBO.
Right. So that, I mean, that's the kind of thing that AT&T is trying to get. If you have people who spend a certain amount of time on YouTube every day, as we talked about, YouTube is largely a free service for the vast majority of people.
Right.
They watch ads. There's right. Netflix. You pay 10, 12 bucks a month for it. You watch as much as you want. They encourage you to binge. They, you know, you can have any number of over-the-top streaming services that are owned by various companies, and they have deals with the content owners, including Time Warner, for their channels. If you want to watch TBS on Sling TV, the owner of Sling, which is Dish Networks, they will make a deal with Time Warner to add TBS and its affiliate stations to that bundle. I mean, that's just the way that over-the-top streaming has worked for the last few years. AT&T now has both the network and it has mm-hmm. the content, but it also, Watch TV is its own $15 a month standalone thing,
right.
which also licenses channels from other companies as well, from Disney, from NBC, you know, all of these competitors as well. So it's really interesting because AT&T may not do it right now, but they have the incentive to make it harder for other companies, for the Sling TVs of the world, to distribute HBO and TBS and DC, you know, DC Universe content, right?
Right.
They won't do that because they don't want to be considered anti-competitive, at least not yet. But they'll find ways to work this in their favor.
Well, sure, and you know, I'm not going to sit here and say that right off the bat, AT&T is going to abuse this and create a monopoly situation. That's a lot of people's concern, and it's a valid concern because they could. I'm not going to say that they will, but they are going to do small things that benefit themselves as any business would do. But because of the position they're in now, those small things are also possibly going to hurt other companies. And that's when it becomes a problem.
For AT&T customers buying into the new two unlimited streaming services, so there's one streaming service that is strangely called, there's AT&T Unlimited and More Premium, and then there's AT&T Unlimited and More, and they're more expensive than their current unlimited plans. They get Watch TV for free, and that content does not count towards their data cap. They have one, you're allowed to add another premium service as well. So in addition to what you get on Watch TV, you're allowed to add other channels like HBO, Cinemax, Showtime, Stars. And then there's a $15 monthly credit towards DirecTV, DirecTV Now, and Uverse TV. And you get 15 gigs of high-speed tethering. So that doesn't come with regular AT&T unlimited plans. And you get high-quality video, which means that you don't have to stream at 480p,
crazy. But let's be clear that in America, at least, Verizon, T-Mobile, and even Sprint on some level, they all have a comparable option that they give you where they've got prorated live TV or video. And that's, you know, AT&T is doing that now and has done it in the past. That's not, you know, quite as big a deal. But I know Verizon especially, they they did not like the idea that every plan on AT&T this holiday shopping season could potentially offer HBO Go or Cinemax Go or, you know, pick one prorated for free. That kills, you know, that Verizon customers that enjoy, you know, maybe they've got a series on HBO that they really like. That will make a Verizon customer look to use AT&T, and there's nothing Verizon can do to counter that. And, you know, I can see the point there. A lot of people say, well, that's just business, but is it fair business?
So the other part of it is the more products AT&T has, you know, under its belt to offer consumers, the more ways they can tie them into a bundle. So AT&T wants people to subscribe to DirecTV by incentivizing discounts with their unlimited plans. Now they have Watch TV, which is yet another bundle that they're putting people into. This is a company that is, it's, you know, UVerse, according to Statista, is not very high on the list in terms of over the top streaming services. It's pretty far down. DirecTV is much higher, but that's more of a terrestrial traditional TV subscription. Comcast is the biggest provider of pay TV in the US with cable. There's Charter as well, which is largely cable. Dish is satellite, and it's number four. There's Verizon, Fios, Cox, and Altice. Sling TV actually has a surprisingly high 2.3 million subscribers, and DirecTV DirecTV now has 1.5 million. So, you know, Watch TV is just another over-the-top product, right?
For now.
So what do you mean? Where does this go?
Well, AT&T is going to be able to leverage this to get Watch TV to grow. And that's great. I want to stress that I am not anti-capitalism or anti-consumer or anti-business in any way or shape or form. I understand how it works, even if I don't like it. But let's say I build up a small media company that caters to children. And previously, I would want to work with, you know, Warner Media to get my service bundled with the Cartoon Network, because that gives me a lot of exposure, because people are going to want to purchase, you know, streaming Cartoon Network content. And if I can be attached onto that, that's great. I will try to work to get that. This reverses it with AT&T owning Warner Media. They could, and they probably won't, but they could say, oh, if you want to be in a bundle with Cartoon Network, you can't be in a bundle with, you know, name another child's programming.
Disney Channel.
With Disney. Okay, you have to cut your ties with Disney if you want to be bundled with Cartoon Network.
Right.
This is the kind of leverage that's possible, and the potential for abuse is there, and that's why so many people are afraid of what AT&T could do. Nobody's saying that they will do it, but it's that they could.
So, Ara, when you see a company like Disney pushing so hard into its own streaming streaming video service, it's launching an ESPN, standalone ESPN product this year. Next year, it's launching a standalone Disney streaming service where it will largely pull out all of its existing content from Netflix and its other partners and bring it in-house. You know, this is, and with Disney looking to buy 21st Century Fox to add its own more adult content to its repertoire, is this just par for the course? Companies need a full spectrum slate of content for all ages, sports, everything, in order to ward off the coming hordes of Netflix and Google and Apple and Facebook and all the others that are competing to create original content.
Well, Disney has its own share of adult entertainment because Disney has Touchstone Pictures. I think they own Miramax now. They have several studios and brands for more adult-oriented content. And then they have, of course, everything in the ABC portfolio, TGIT, Scandal, Grey's Anatomy, all of that. So I don't think that's so much a kids versus adult content, but with a Disney subscription service, what I, as a Disney fan, and probably a lot of parents are going is, oh, thank God, I can just find it all in one place now. Because right now, depending on what you want to watch, whether it's a certain TV show or a certain movie, you're going to have to look one of six different services or platforms to find it. Some Disney movies are on Netflix. Some Disney movies are on Hulu. Some of them you can only get through Movies Anywhere. That's even more true for TV shows because TV shows in general are harder to find on streaming services for particular types of content because TV shows are more used to they're exclusively on one platform. So I'm happy that it's all going to be in one place, and I'm sure I'm not alone there. But when it comes to streaming services, especially for like smaller niche content, like Jerry, you were mentioning Crunchyroll earlier. Crunchyroll, it has a deal with Funimation and with other smaller niche nerdy services, and they've bundled into what they call, I think it's like a VRV value pack or something, but it's $10 a month for like 8 different streaming services that are geared towards Japanese content, nerd content, that sort of thing. So
Yeah, they're probably barely making a profit off that. And imagine if AT&T says, hey, we'll pick you up, but only for, you know, you have to cut your price to us by 20%. They're going to lose money. They can't do it.
I don't see something like that happening quite as much.
Well, maybe not for that particular content, but along those lines that where AT&T can now throw its weight around.
I mean, Comcast did the same thing, right? When bought NBC Universal.
And
it
Comcast
said,
is, you know, evil as evil can be. We all know that.
Right. But at the same time, Comcast, for all of its nefarious dealings with customers and the fact that most Americans hate them as a cable provider, they've been fairly hands off in terms of NBC and its own and NBC's content, right? They've let them do their own thing.
And most people that aren't clutching their pearls pretty much think that AT&T is going to do the same, maybe because Comcast and AT&T are afraid that they have to.
Well, I mean, there's no question that some companies, right? Like Fox, what we've seen over the last few weeks is creators that license content to Fox have come out against Fox News publicly, right? So there's like, you can't really, it, so CNN, for instance, Turner owns CNN in addition to a bunch of other stations, right? NBC. And so every major content owner has its own news subsidiary, right? Yeah. Right? And that's fine. I mean, that's par for the course. But when it comes to the assets themselves, all these major corporations are just looking for the next big hit show. I mean, that's really what it is. It's not the HBO is only the sum of its shows, right? And if HBO didn't have Game of Thrones, it probably wouldn't be in a position, in the position it is today. I mean, HBO has had countless hit shows, right? But there are certain times where it has more leverage than others.
Right.
And there are certain times where before a new season of Game of Thrones, they could really push their weight around and promote HBO Now and really be a behemoth in the streaming space. It's very unlikely that AT&T is going to go in there and start dictating terms.
No, I don't think, and I want to make that clear, I don't think AT&T is ever going to do any of this stuff. I'm not even saying that they want to do this stuff. My problem is that they could. And they shouldn't have that temptation.
The other side of the coin, though, is the actual infrastructure conversation. So AT&T is the second largest wireless provider in the U.S. It's also it also owns a lot of cable and I believe it even has a small fiber business, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
So they do own the pipes, and we've seen with Level 3 and Netflix and Comcast. Netflix has had to pay to make sure that because they own, they provide so much downlink bandwidth to through the pipes of the various American service providers, they've had to pay to optimize their streams. It's fairly obvious what's going to happen here, right?
Yeah.
AT&T is just going to demand their pound of flesh,
sure,
if they haven't already, because now they have even more leverage.
And they'll probably get away with it right now.
Yeah, they will.
And, you know, maybe they should be able to get away with it. Maybe they shouldn't. That's a discussion, you know, that everybody's going to have their own opinion. I feel that they shouldn't be able to do that right now. But they know that now is the time to strike. So I fully expect to hear that kind of news little by little. They won't deluge it all at once.
Oh, you want to hear something funny, Jerry?
Yes, always.
You know, you mentioned Crunchyroll earlier.
Mm-hmm.
As this, like, independent anime service.
They're probably not independent.
They're
not
owned
really.
By AT&T.
Ah, okay. Poor example, but the sentiment still stands.
Yeah, no, I know. I was looking up exactly what AT&T owns, and they own a company called Otter Media, and Otter Media owns Crunchyroll.
You know, back to the infrastructure, Time Warner brings not necessarily infrastructure itself, but some pretty neat technologies. Bluefin, well, that's what runs Twitter. Time Warner is heavily invested in Bluefin. They're heavily invested in Google through acquisitions of companies that they either owned outright or were the majority shareholder of and Google bought. Glue Mobile, Discord. These are all names that are popular internet technology companies that are Warner Media. I'm sure there's others. Those are just the ones I know off the top of my head, especially Discord, because, you know, people, if you're familiar with Discord, it's a chat service for people who play games. You like to use it a lot. But it's got gamer people on it, and gamer people tend to be very vocal. And they were losing their collective stuff over AT&T is going to close it down. Well, they're not going to close it down. Don't worry. But that's how I know they. I don't think they own it outright, but they have a controlling interest in it.
Discord is freeware.
Well, the service, the back end era.
Mm.
You know, somebody has to run the servers that make it work. So you have to, is any of that going to leverage in with, you know, AT&T controls the pipe that gets your content to the consumer, and they possibly own some of the technology that's used to get it there through their acquisition of Warner Media. It's just a big, I think you could never stop diving and you'd find something new under each layer.
And it's not going to stop for at least the next 3 or 4 years. And it's happening with all sorts of media. I mean, I work at a Raycom TV station. My station went up for sale yesterday because Raycom Media merged with Gray Media because they have to merge to survive in this economy. And now that the government is a little bit more willing to let larger media mm-hmm. companies merge, that's going to happen more and more often. So I don't see it ending with Time Warner and AT&T. I see it going even further.
So who can T-Mobile buy?
they bought Level 3. They're launching their own over-the-top streaming TV service this year, too.
Yeah.
They have Sprint in the go. I mean, T-Mobile is owned by a Deutsche Telekom parent company. Sprint is owned by SoftBank. I mean, these are companies that are hugely leveraged, and they will also look to make this kind of deal.
And we in the States, we tend to have this little love affair with T-Mobile, but T-Mobile is not the good guy. They're not your friend. They're the face of a giant European conglomerate of all things.
So, yeah, it's really interesting. You're right. So they have Warner Media has an investment in Bluefin. They have an investment in Discord, Glue Mobile, Meebo, which was acquired by Google.
It was another ad service, ad field, ad something.
Adify.
that Google just bought that they were a major.
Yeah, there's a lot of tendrils here. So, I mean, this is not the end of the conversation. We're going to talk about this once, once we have more information. We know that Disney is competing. Who's Disney competing with on 21st Century Fox? I forget.
Pretty sure that was Comcast, and I'm pretty sure they got that Fox said no. We're Disney up there big, and Fox says yeah, we're probably going to stick with that because it's an all stock deal, meaning it's going to get more valuable as
it's Comcast
things progress and as the deal pushes forward, because Disney stock just doesn't really seem to go down because Marvel, Lucasfilm, and of course Disney movies are highly profitable. I think we've had $2 or $3 billion films already this year from the Disney portfolio.
So the latest, latest word is that 21st Century Fox would prefer to be purchased by Disney because a deal with Comcast would have more antitrust risk. Comcast is more in the same field. It has more infrastructure. It would probably not pass muster, even though the FCC would probably approve Disney buying every company in the U.S. Right now because it wants mergers upon mergers.
Well, and that's something that we didn't even touch on. I think what bothers me the most about it is that our own Justice Department did not want this to happen, and it just went through so easily without, it's like there was no debate. It just, here's my rubber stamp. Please give me some papers. I want to stamp things.
So, yeah, that's how mergers are going to be under this administration, because the Justice Department did not want this. And the only reason it's going through now is because the administration has finally installed people at justice at those levels in order to ensure that things go through as needed.
Yeah, and that will have an enormous, a big impact on future deals like this. So we will definitely see Disney acquire. I think Disney will end up acquiring 21st Century Fox. I don't think it'll go to Comcast, and we'll have yet another behemoth on our hands.
Let's be real, Disney's already a behemoth.
Oh, it is. It's huge.
I mean, between Disney, ABC, Marvel, and Lucasfilm, Disney was already huge, but it's all content.
And I can hear people listening now, oh, Fox, Fox News, I don't care about that. No, 21st Century Fox, you love something from that company, just like you did Warner Media. You know, this does involve you.
All right. Well, I think we're going to end it there today because my 1 hour podcast is now an hour and a half, and we all have to do our things. So, Ara, this was a really great conversation, and we'll have you back when we talk more about streaming because there's lots more to talk about. Thank you for joining us.
Yes. Thank you. I kind of have a handle on what I'm paying for now.
Yeah.
And Ara, I mean, we said this on the last podcast. Please get Ara here because none of us have a clue about how any of this works. It's just so confusing. And you gave us some enlightenment.
Yeah, they make it more complicated than it is, but the long story short, YouTube Premium is the only thing y'all should be paying for. That's the only YouTube subscription right now, apart from if you can get YouTube TV. YouTube Premium is the only tier you should even look at, because everything else just isn't as good of a value for what you will get.
Yeah. Cool. And Jerry, thank you for your insights on Time Warner and AT&T, and for all of your awesome, awesome recommendations. Thank you, everybody listening to this who tuned in twice in a week. We will have a third podcast for you coming up on Friday, so look forward to that. And
podcast
as always,
Central.
Thanks for listening. And we'll see you again soon. Bye-bye.
Adios.
Bye.